Hello, podcast listeners. This is Rob again, and I'd like to ask you for a favor. As I often say, our mission here at Amplify Process Safety is to save lives by helping companies improve their process safety programs. However, we can only meet our mission by working with more companies, and that's where you come in. If your company needs a PSM audit, or perhaps needs help with a process hazard analysis, or maybe you don't know how to submit an RMP plan to EPA, let us know. These are all things that we can help with. At Amplify Process Safety, we are experts in all aspects of PSM and RMP regulations, including PHAs, mechanical integrity, management of change, and we also have lots of useful knowledge related to NFPA requirements, combustible dust, etc. So if you or someone at your company could use our help or just wants to talk about some things related to process safety, please don't hesitate to reach out. Whenever you want to, you can reach me on my direct line, 207-229-0862. And as I said, if you know of anyone who can use our services, please let us know. Till next time, be safe out there.
Welcome to Amplify Your Process Safety, the podcast that provides the experience and expertise you need when it comes to process safety and risk management. Our hands-on approach will give you the insight needed, whether you're new to industry or process safety, in a role where you interact with aspects of process safety, or an experienced process safety professional. Join us in our mission to protect people, the companies they work for, and the communities where they operate by making process safety knowledge available to all.
Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Amplify Your Process Safety podcast. I'm Rob Bartlett. Thank you for joining us. In this episode, I'm happy to be welcoming Eric Hirsch. Eric is a principal process engineer at Nexus Engineering Group, LLC, who has a vast experience in all manner of design-related topics. These days, Eric works in process design with a focus on pressure relief devices. A fun fact about Eric, or at least I think it's fun, is that Eric and I were actually classmates at Cornell University back in the early 90s, and we actually shared an apartment, not once, but actually twice. So I guess I wasn't too hard to live with back then, huh, Eric? Welcome to the show.
No, you were quite tolerable, Rob. It's good to be with you again.
Probably the best I could get is a tolerable. So I'll take that. So, back in episode, I went back for more. Yes. Yeah. All right. So back in episode 45, Molly and I discussed the piping requirements for pressure relief devices. There were additional questions that were prompted from the audience about this. So I looked into my network to see who I thought might be able to answer some of these questions. And I thought Eric would be perfect for that. So Eric, thought maybe the best place to start would be to start with an overview of some of the basic requirements for pressure relief devices and the calculations that go with them.
Well, pretty much every pressure vessel that a site has on hand will require some sort of overpressure calculation to determine that in the event of a process upset, whether it's a cooling water failure, a control valve failing open, an operator inadvertently opening a valve or closing a valve, a fire, any one of a number of scenarios, that there is a relief device installed on that piece of pressure equipment that is sized to prevent that piece of equipment from exceeding its stamped maximum allowable working pressure, or MAWP. So it is important to document that you have looked at all of those scenarios and done the calculations to determine that both the relief valve and the piping that is associated with that relief valve are adequately sized for all valid overpressure scenarios.
So when you say sized, we're talking not just the diameter, but there's also other aspects of that, right, that would go into the sizing?
That is correct. The available relief area of the device is one aspect of those sizing calculations, but as Molly Myers mentioned previously on an earlier podcast, there are also requirements and limitations in regards to the allowable inlet and outlet pressure drop on a relief device. So those things also need to be taken into consideration when designing a pressure relieving system.
Okay. So let's talk about back pressures.
because if I've got a pressure vessel and I've got a nozzle with some sort of relief device, a safety valve or a rupture disc, you know, I've got pressure built up in that vessel, and I want to get the whole purpose for this. I want to get it out of there to a safe location so it doesn't literally blow up whatever the vessel is. We get shrapnel, we get fatalities, bad things happen. Maybe we have toxicity, maybe we have fires, all sorts of bad stuff happens. So if I have my relief device, not only is the sizing important, but the flow, the throughput through that vessel through the pressure relief device is important as well. That's another factor. And that's going to be partly dependent on how much back pressure I have in my system, right? So how do you deal with that?
Well, there are certain guidelines that API code specifies. In regards to inlet piping, there's a strict specification that any component that is in the inlet piping, its cross-sectional area shall not be less than the inlet of the relief device. And that's generally recommended on the outlet as well. The thinking being that you don't want to have a restriction in the flow out of your relief device. So you want to make sure that the flow area is at least as big as your PSV outlet. Along those lines, it's important to use only gate valves or ball valves if you're going to install an isolation valve on the inlet and or outlet piping. Because if you use butterfly valves or globe valves, the internal components of those valves will restrict the flow path. And so those are explicitly not allowed per API code. In addition, those valves, especially the butterfly valves, don't really provide tight shutoff. So if you need to take a relief valve out of service, there's really no way of getting positive isolation from your flare header unless you take the entire flare header system down. And admittedly, lots of chemical plants and refineries will lose a lot of money if they need to take their flare header down, because you're talking about taking down an entire production unit generally.
Right, right. So, okay, there's limitations on what we can do for valving, and obviously not having restrictions makes a lot of sense. What else we have that we should be, you know, kind of thinking about related to back pressure?
Well, when it comes to doing the piping pressure drop calculations, API 521 specifies whether you should be using required or rated relief loads for those calculations. Generally, it is recommended that the rated capacities of those devices be used, with the exception of modulating pilot devices and thermal relief valves requiring less than 10% of the available relief area. I have some clients who will use required relief rates for their pressure drop calcs for liquid relief cases, the thinking being that unlike a gas, which is compressible, for a liquid relief, you can really only relieve what's being put into the system. So there's really no point at which those clients feel that you would ever have to relieve the rated capacity of the relief device, only the required capacity. Now, some clients will still design their systems based on the rated capacity because it gives you the flexibility. If you decide to increase production rates somewhere down the line, you don't wind up having to change the piping and relief valve design.
Which you definitely don't want to do.
Yes, there are also a couple of clients. API makes a specification that if a relief device exhibits modulating characteristics, basically that it will adjust its opening percentage based on how much flow you have going through it, in the same way a modulating pilot would do, you are allowed to use required relief rates. And I actually have documentation for the Crosby J series and Consolidated 1900 series valves that explicitly says you can use required relief rates. Again, okay. Rated relief rates are conservative design when you're doing the piping pressure drops. But for existing plants, sometimes it's worth looking into whether or not you can use the required relief rates to validate that your system is adequately protected.
So let's talk about, you mentioned it a little bit about piping, you know, after your relief device. So we come out of our, say it's a safety valve and we've got discharge from that. We're going to go someplace. It's got to be a safe location. That safe location might be a flare system. That safe location might be some sort of knockout vessel that then relieves to the atmosphere. It's got to be to a safe location, but what impact does the piping configuration have? And, you know, I guess maybe related to that, and I don't know if this is getting a little bit too much into the weeds, but related to that would be, you know, manifolded pressure relief systems where you've got multiple PRDs heading, you know, going into a header that then maybe goes to a flare or something like that. So maybe two questions there, but take a swing.
Sure. If you've got a manifold or multiple relief valves protecting the same piece of equipment, it's important to evaluate the back pressure of the entire relieving system, since all of the relief valves will have to go off simultaneously. So you can't look at the pressure drop just through an individual tailpipe off of a relief valve. You need to look at the pressure drop through that common subheader to make sure that with all of that flow going through the common subheader, that you're not going to exceed the back pressure limitations on the valve or provide enough back pressure that the capacity of those individual relief valves is negatively impacted. Along the same lines, if there is a global relief scenario, such as a power failure in a unit or a cooling water failure or a fire that's in a particular area of the plant that could engulf multiple pieces of equipment, it's important to look at the developed header back pressure from all of those relief devices going off simultaneously. So it's just something that you need to be aware of. There are modeling software that's out there, whether it's Aspen FlareNet, Visual Flare. I'm sure there are other manufacturers that I can't remember off the top of my head, but there are ways to go about modeling back pressures to make sure that your system is adequately designed.
So really, for any sort of complexity in a system, you can't just do this on the back of an envelope. I mean, you've really got to get pretty hardcore as far as getting modeling, you know, and to understand what's going to happen to make sure that you can size your device adequately. Is that right?
That's correct. If you're relieving to atmosphere, that's generally not an issue. If you've got multiple relief valves going off at the same time, they're all tying into one vent line that goes to the atmosphere, then maybe you have to look at the combined effect of those relief valves going off at the same time. But if you have an individual relief valve that's just discharging the atmosphere, obviously this isn't an issue. It's really relief to a closed flare header system or knockout pot where reliefs from other pieces of equipment going off simultaneously could impact the relief capacity of a different relief system.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Okay. So what else do we have related to relief devices that it was interesting to talk about? One was identifying fire zones and circles. What do you mean by that?
Well, API, I believe it's 521, specifies that when you're looking at a fire zone or a circle, as they sometimes call it, you want to look at if you were to have a pool fire in an area due to a leak of flammable material, how much equipment could actually be engulfed by that same fire. API makes recommendations of using an area roughly the size of 2,500 to 5,000 square feet. Individual sites may have their own guidelines. It's acceptable to use curbed areas where liquid could accumulate. Maybe you base the fire zones around the location of drains that are in the area that could be under equipment where that leaking liquid would tend to accumulate. But it's, again, just one of those things where it's important to look at how many vessels could be going off simultaneously. Some clients I know have been ultra conservative and have just assumed that an entire production unit is engulfed in flames at the same time.
And then run that calculations to make sure that everything will relieve without blowing up.
That is correct. And when you're evaluating these global relief scenarios, it's acceptable to use the required relief rates going off and being vented to the flare as opposed to the rated rates. The rated rates is something that you need to look at for individual relief devices where a valve could go full open immediately upon lifting. And so you want to make sure that the pressure drop in the system can adequately handle that.
Can handle that. Oh. Right. Okay. All right. So one of the issues that goes into our whole thinking about PSVs is if there's a fire, how big could it be? How much equipment could be engulfed in that one fire? So that all makes sense. Now we've talked a little bit about knockout pots and stuff. What sorts of design issues should we be looking at with those sorts of vessels?
Well, when sizing a flare knockout pot, it's important to consider how much liquid you could have getting into that vessel. You want to make sure that there's enough liquid holdup time in the vessel so that if you had a relief, an operator can get out there and either mitigate the relieving situation or at the very least turn on a pump at the bottom of the knockout vessel that could pump any accumulated liquid out of the system. Because by no means do you want to overflow a flare knockout pot, send liquid down to a flare, and basically have a fire at the base of the flare. That would not be a good thing.
No, that would definitely not be a good thing. Okay. Now, one of the things that I've seen, seen over the years, you've got some facilities that use ruptured discs all the time, or, most of the time. You've got some facilities that don't. So what are your comments about the use of ruptured discs for overpressure protection?
Well, rupture discs are completely acceptable to use for overpressure protection. There is a portion of API 520 Part 1 that specifies how you can use the same sizing equations that you would use for a relief device to determine whether or not a rupture disc is adequately sized. But it's important to note that there are some very strict limitations on when the PSV sizing formula can be used for determining if a rupture disc installed in the same location is adequately sized. There are limitations as far as the piping diameter, the length of the discharge. That discharge has to be going to atmosphere. If all of those limitations are not met, then the best way and the only way per API to evaluate whether the rupture disc is adequately sized is to basically do a calculation looking at the piping resistances for flow. You basically do a factored, instead of a coefficient of discharge method, you use the recommended flow resistance method to determine how much flow you can get through the system. And those pressure drop calcs can all be done at required relief rates because you don't have the same, system response that you would have with a relief valve because you don't have a valve that's reshutting. Once that rupture disc opens, it's wide open and there's no resistance to flow.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons not to use a rupture disc is if you do have something where it's going to be bad news if once you break the rupture disc, now you've got that system wide open to the atmosphere. Perhaps you've got oxygen coming back in and getting into the system, or there's all sorts of bad things that might happen with that. So there's some special things what we need to consider when doing rupture discs versus doing safety valves.
Yes.
Okay. So what about instrumentation? How does instrumentation, kind of tie into this whole thing? Can I take credit for instrumentation that I have or interlocks I have? How does that work?
Well, generally, you cannot take credit for the favorable response of instrumentation in reducing a relief load, because the way the API looks at it is if you have one control system fail that's tied into a basic process control system, any one of a number of other systems could similarly fail, and you can't assume that the system is going to respond as you would expect it to mitigate the overpressure scenario. The exception to that is the use of HIPS, or a highly instrumented protective system. Those instrumentation systems require a more robust design, generally 2 out of 2 or 2 out of 3 indication that will trip either the energy input into a system that's causing the relief scenario, or may just shut a valve to shut feed off into a system. But there are additional requirements regarding how robust the instrumentation is, and also how often those instrumentation systems are inspected, because obviously if you're relying on those systems for overpressure protection, they need to be inspected more often than your basic process control system, which may not get inspected once every 5 years, 10 years, something of that nature.
Right. What you're basically saying is a multi-sensor situation where you've got multiple sensors feeding into some sort of PLC or something that is then going to take an action, shut off a feed or some such thing. But that's totally different than our basic process control, right? I mean, what we're talking about more is almost like a SIS or something like that, right?
Yes, exactly. A SIS being a safety instrumented system. And exactly what level of components and how redundant you need that instrumentation shutdown system, a lot of that comes down to what sort of a risk you're looking to mitigate. Mm-hmm. Looking at how likely the system is to fail, what sort of consequences you could have. And this would all stem back to a PHA or a LOPA analysis mm-hmm. that may drive what level of seal protection, SIL, is necessary in your instrumentation design.
Mm-hmm. You brought up PHAs, and obviously we use, in PHAs, we use the overpressure protection all the time as a safeguard. And one of the requirements we have for safeguards is that they be independent. So of course, using the approach that you're talking about, kind of taking it out of the realm of design and calculations and everything, and just looking at it from a safeguard standpoint, we want those safeguards to be independent so that if one fails, we have the other one. So if that SIS fails, we have our rupture disc. So it sounds like it all kind of ties in together back with the calculation situation for that particular example.
That's correct. If you're relying on a high level interlock to shut off feed to a vessel to keep it from overfilling, you don't want the transmitter that you're sending that interlock signal to be coming from the same transmitter that you're using for level control. As you said, right. You want those to be independent systems that you don't have one common failure mode.
Right. And as I said, that ties into the rupture disc design side, as well as on the other side, the process safety side, or the PHA as well.
That instrumentation can be used to not only mitigate relief scenarios, prevent them from even happening. It can provide relief where maybe a relief valve or a rupture disc may not be effective. Maybe it will respond too slowly. That instrumentation can be used to reduce the likelihood of multiple reliefs going off at the same time or reduce the demand on a relief device. All of that can play into lowering the risk assessment and the risk level in your PHA process.
Right. Okay. I had another question for you related to the material that we're trying to relieve. So you mentioned, I think, phases or at least single phase flow. But what about in situations, which we have a lot of, where you've got perhaps a liquid as well as vapor, or you've got liquid as well as polymer that you have to evaluate or that you've got to evacuate from your system? How do you deal with that within designing your relief devices?
Well, there are different relief valve calculations that you use depending on whether you're relieving a single phase fluid, such as a gas or a liquid, or whether you are relieving a two phase fluid, whether it's something that is all liquid when it enters the relief valve and it's flashing across the relief device, or it is two phase entering the relief device and maybe it continues to flash, maybe it's just nitrogen and a non-boiling component that are relieving simultaneously. But there are separate sizing equations in API that you would use for something like that. And again, the impact on the design of any flare knockout pod is you want to make sure that you have adequate disengagement of the liquid and the vapor in that flare knockout pot, which comes into evaluating the liquid holdup time before you would expect an operator to get out there and respond to the vessel, your knockout vessel filling up, and making sure that you have enough disengagement area for any droplets that may be flammable to settle out from the relieving vapor.
Because again, bad to send liquid to your flare.
Yes.
Bad.
Yes. Important note there.
Well, you thought it was a bad day when your relief device went off. It's going to be a worse day if your flare gets liquid to it. So that was one of my other questions. I had another very, I guess, a very simple question, but I get asked it a fair amount, and I'm curious as to how you would answer this. So maybe this is a little bit scary, but there are facilities that I go into that it's obvious to me don't have enough pressure relief devices. And so a question that I get asked, and again, I'm curious of your answer, is do I have to have calculations? Number one, do I have to have overpressure protection on every, let's say, pressure vessel and or piping system? That's first part of the question. And then the other is, do I need to have calculations for all of those?
Well, you don't necessarily have to have a relief device on every piece of pressure equipment. But if you don't, you need to have an open path for relief between those pieces of equipment. And you need to take into consideration that the relieving fluid could generate a pressure drop between those two pieces of equipment. And whatever you set your relief device at, if it is going to protect multiple pieces of equipment, it needs to be set low enough so that the allowable accumulation above the MAWP of any piece of equipment in that system is not exceeded when that relief valve is open. So it's not an issue if you want to car seal valves open between, let's say, an overhead condenser and an overhead accumulator and the top of a distillation tower. That's not necessarily an issue, but you need to take into account that there's going to be some pressure drop between those components. And so if you relieve at the upstream most piece of equipment, then you protect everything downstream, assuming they all are rated at the same maximum allowable working pressure. If they're not, it's just something that you need to take into consideration, because obviously you don't want a relief valve. If you have two pieces of equipment there rated at 50 pounds and there's 10 pounds of pressure drop between the two of them, when you're at your governing relief scenario, then one of those vessels could be at 60 pounds and exceed the allowable overpressure. So it's something that you need to take into consideration. You aren't prohibited from using car sealed valves to keep an open relief path, but I've seen some clients try to car seal open valves to keep five or six pieces of equipment protected by the same relief device, and they've never done the pressure drop calculations between them.
Right.
That, again, can result in a very bad day.
Yeah, that seems like that would be asking for trouble. So that's the first question. The second question is, do I need calculations for every relief device I have, whether it's on my chemical process, whether it's on a hot oil supply line, whether it's on a water system?
If you have a stamped piece of equipment, ASME Section 8, ASME Section 1, that has a stamped pressure rating, it is required that you have documentation to show that it is adequately protected against overpressure. OSHA, if they decide to come to your site and do an audit, is going to be looking for that. And I've seen many a client be fined for not having that sort of documentation readily available.
Even if they did it. If they don't have it readily available, how many clients? Okay, going off of that, how many clients have you had that either as a result of an internal audit or, unfortunately, maybe the result of an enforcement audit, couldn't lay their hands on those calculations, so they've come to you to basically recreate them to verify that their current installation is adequate.
I can tell you that a lot of the work that Nexus has gotten over the last 15 years or so is directly the result of a revalidation project where OSHA had gone to our client, had asked for documentation that was not able to be readily provided. Yeah. And so it fell on our company to do the revalidation of nearly every relief device in their operating refinery.
Which is definitely not small.
No, it kept us busy for a while, but it is something that OSHA will look for. You don't necessarily need relief devices on vendor provided pieces of equipment, but that vendor should be able to provide documentation that shows that the relief devices that they installed are adequately sized.
Right. This really all, comes down to, making sure that you've designed your process, making sure that you're managing the design paperwork that comes from that. And, normally when we talk about doing PHAs, we're looking at things, like P&IDs and electrical classification drawings and stuff like that. But more and more, I'm getting more clients that are part of the expectation. And maybe it's because they've run into problems at some of their facilities with inspections from OSHA or EPA. The part of the PHA process is to validate that the scenarios that we're looking at in PHAs are actually included in the relief calculation assumptions so that we can take credit for that, because, you can't really take credit for a safeguard if it's not going to actually protect you from the scenario.
This is definitely true. I will state that generally it is a good idea to do a revalidation of your relief devices on a 5-year cycle. It's not always possible. I know money, a lot of clients can be tight. Yep. And it's a relatively extensive effort depending on the facility you're looking at, because it's necessary to, you know, validate that you have accurate P&IDs, accurate equipment files, instrumentation files. It is a time-consuming exercise that if you're just looking at those sorts of issues as part of a small project PHA, you may underestimate how long that activity is actually going to take.
You definitely will underestimate it. Definitely underestimate it. Okay, so I think we're probably coming up against it here. What do you have any other things you wanted to throw out there before we head off?
Just a couple very briefly. Along the lines of flare vessel design, it's important to consider actual loading on the flare and the thermal radiation that could be expected from a large release. There are limitations as far as the thermal radiation at grade to prevent injury to people. This is the reason that a lot of companies will have a restricted area around the base of their flare, mm-hmm. so that someone in normal work clothes doesn't venture too close when that flare is going off, because there is no SPF that will protect you in those instances.
No, I would think not.
Some other topics Molly talked about in her previous podcast, the preliminary design for inlet and outlet piping. I generally like to specify inlet and outlet piping that's at least one pipe diameter larger than the PSV inlet and outlet during the early phases of design. I also like to do a calculation that basically tells my pipers how much inlet and outlet piping they can get away with and still meet API recommended limits on pressure drop. This gives them a window, and it helps prevent rework, which, as Molly pointed out, can lead to schedule delays, cost overruns. Doing a conservative design up front can save a lot of aggravation down the road.
Okay, good point.
And the other topic would be regarding inlet piping pressure drops that may exceed the 3% limit set forth in API. There are ways that you can install and have a system be adequate with above a 3% inlet piping pressure drop. One of the ways to do that is to perform a force balance assessment. There's been some work by Groms, Melham, and the company IO Mosaic, who've all issued papers on the subject. And you basically look at the stability of the valve, the forces on the valve when the relief device is going off. And you can estimate whether chatter is likely or not. In some cases, you may just have a low frequency cycling of the valve going open and shut, as opposed to rapid chatter that could damage the valve. So looking at your maintenance records, you could have no indication that chatter was ever an issue. But I also have some clients who, if the only valid relief case for a relief device is a fire, they may not care if their inlet piping pressure drop is 3.5% at rated relief rates, because they're going to tear out that relief device immediately after the incident anyway. Right. So API says to use sound engineering judgment. That would be my recommendation. Now, there are ways that you can show your system is adequate, even if that inlet drop exceeds 3%.
Okay. Well, hey, I think we've probably covered a lot there. And for people who are not really experts in relief devices and maybe just come across them at, you know, as part of your day in and day out job, but don't know what goes on behind the scenes with those, hopefully you got some good ideas here about things that you should be asking your engineering folks and things that you should be looking for. Eric, why don't you give the listeners any way to contact you or a website or anything like that you'd like to point them to?
Sure. The company is Nexus Engineering Group. We're based out of the Cleveland, Ohio office, or I am. My email, direct email, is eric.hirsch, eric.hirsch, at Nexus E Group, NexusEGroup.com. And my direct phone number is 216-456-8564.
All right, great. And I assume anybody can, with any follow-up questions directly, can give you a call. If you, however, have a comment about this week's episode, a general comment, don't ask me anything too specific for pressure relief devices. But if you have a general question or an idea for a future podcast or question about anything else process related, I'd love to hear from you. You can send us a voicemail using the link in our episode description, or you can always shoot an email to podcast@amplifyconsultants.com. And finally, our goal at Amplify Process Safety is to save lives by partnering with companies that handle highly hazardous chemicals to create a world-class process safety system, as it is our firm belief that these systems will help prevent catastrophic incidents like fires, explosions, and toxic releases. Please don't hesitate to reach out to us if we can help you on your process safety journey. So, Eric, thank you very much for being on the show. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, Rob. It's good working with you again.
All right. And for those of you listening, thank you very much. And until next time, be safe out there.
We appreciate you joining us for this episode of Amplify Your Process Safety. Head to our website, amplifyconsultants.com, to find our show notes and other resources. Thank you for joining us in our mission to ultimately save lives by advancing process safety right here on Amplify Your Process Safety. Until next time.